Well, good morning. It's a genuine privilege and honor for me to be here today, have opportunity in these next day and a half to get to know you a little bit and talk to you about some issues. And so I also want to greet you from Union University. We have sent you some of our worst students, and I know that you've had, We've sent you some great students, which is a sign of our trust in you, that you will help continue to form them well, and they are wonderful, wonderful men and women, and we're so grateful that God sent them to Union and now has brought them to the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. What else shall I say? Oh, I want to let you know that the lectures are somewhat self-contained, but there is a trajectory. I'm moving in a direction. We'll move from Homo sapiens this morning and Homo faber, looking at human beings as knowers and makers. And then I'm going to raise some what I hope will be provocative questions that I hope to get to toward the end of the day tomorrow when we finish up by looking at Homo Deus, that is, human beings as God. I'll say more about that as we go. There's no heresy involved that I know of, but I'd be very happy for you to point it out if there is. It hasn't escaped me this morning that we're beginning a discussion about technology that moves toward the immortality, the potential for technological immortality. It hasn't escaped me this morning that we begin this on Ash Wednesday with the reminder that from dust we have come and to dust we shall return. And the promise of the techno-utopians is that from dust we have come and to circuitry or the internet we shall go, something like that. And that's the trajectory we're going to move on as we talk about technology. Here we have some emblems or symbols of the direction we're going to go from Homo sapiens to Homo faber to the potential for robo sapiens with the emerging technologies like robotics and artificial intelligence we'll talk about tomorrow, to a brand new volume by Yuval Harari, Homo Deus, that as a historian predicts the future, which is a very interesting process. I wonder how he'll get his academic affirmation by being historian who looks toward the future, but that's what he's doing. And he's a very, very interesting, provocative writer, and we'll talk about him tomorrow as well. Anytime we talk about technology, especially emerging technologies, there are a couple of different reactions. Albert Borgman points out that for some people, technologies, even simple, what are now simple technologies, you remember we call this simple now. It didn't used to exist at all, and number two, when it did exist, it took up a whole floor of a building that had to be specially cooled to even approximate something like a computer, and it causes great exhilaration in some people. It's like a carnival ride. It's like a roller coaster, but for other people, it is frightening. And so I anticipate that we'll enter a conversation today, this afternoon, and tomorrow that will reflect both of those kind of attitudes, both of those kinds of personalities, if you will. Some of you are enamored with the new technologies and can't wait to stand outside at the Apple store the next time some new gadget comes out, and others worry about the direction technology is taking us. So we'll have that conversation, I hope. Where I want to begin is by kind of laying the groundwork for what I've called here Creation 1.0, and you might imagine that we're going to contrast that with maybe a future narrative about creation. But this is something that we'll be familiar with, and I want to begin here with this cultural mandate. God blessed those, Adam and Eve, those in the garden, and he said to them, be fruitful, multiply, and he calls on them to have a stewardship kind of dominion, a stewardship kind of life in the world, which implies, at least, that there might be some technologies involved, since the command and the invitation to work and keep the garden, remember, this is prior to the fall, the command or invitation to work and keep the garden is one that is going to require technologies, unless Adam and Eve are supposed to do it with their hands, which I take is not the case, and I'll show you why in just a moment. But they are to be keepers and workers, tillers and carers, protectors of this garden, this paradise that God has made. And the language that's used in Genesis chapter 2 is language that is reminiscent of, or that's picked up later in the language of the temple and the worshipful care and worshipful work of the priests in the temple. It's sacrificial type of language. It's very provocative in itself, because it reminds us that this is a sacred calling, that the calling that God has placed upon Adam and Eve and then all of their progeny, including you and me, that calling is a sacred task. It's a sacred calling to work and keep, to till and care for, to be stewards of the world that God has entrusted to us as His vice regents in the created order, if you will. And so we follow the Genesis timeline, or follow the Genesis trajectory here. Human beings are called and invited to be knowers. They are Homo sapiens, human knowers. But there are set limits. There are things that they are not to know. You shall not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You shall not attempt to be as gods. Secondly, they're workers and carers, as we said, and they're observers and classifiers. You remember God brought all of the animals before Adam, and the text of Genesis says, and Adam named the animals. I take it that he wasn't giving them what we call Christian names. He wasn't saying this is Bill and this is Mary and this is Fido and this is Tawana and this is whoever, but he is doing some sort of classification of the animals. I believe that because Adam, after all of those animals are paraded before him, Adam notices that there's no one like him. But for Adam, there wasn't found anyone like him. And Adam is aware of that. There's Mr. Hippopotamus and Mrs. Hippopotamus and Mr. Giraffe and Mrs. Giraffe, but there's no one corresponding to him. So he's doing some sort of at least elementary classification. And then we know the story of the fall as we continue the trajectory of Genesis, that human beings sin against God, and we are continuing to reap the consequences of that fall. So they sow leaves together. They weave skins to cover their nakedness, unless you're in West Tennessee, and then it's nakedness. And they hide from God. By the way, I noticed as I was doing some research on this that there is another word or another spelling for the vocation of sowing. Some people like to call it a sowist, a person a sowist, because of the implications of this spelling. Sewers is not a really wonderful vocation. And then they are to be technologists for survival and subsistence. They are to employ their stewardship calling in ways, their keeping and their tilling, their caring, their protecting in ways that are going to require technology. And if you follow the narrative, that's exactly what you see. There is city building in the narrative. There is tool making in the narrative. There is agriculture, which is going to require tools or technology. Boat building with Noah and presumably after. With Nimrod, there is weapon making. And then by the time we get to Genesis chapter 11, there is another potential. In fact, there is another catastrophe, and that is what we might describe, or what I want to at least suggest we describe, as a kind of technological idolatry. By building the ziggurat, by building the tower, humankind is trying to make a name for itself, trying to, in hubris, in arrogance, exalt itself above its creaturely status. So Graham Houston, in his book Virtual Morality, says, or points out, excavated inscriptions indicate that these towers, the Tower of Babel and others in that era, were meant to serve as stairways to heaven. They had a purely religious significance and no practical use apart from religious ritual. According to the biblical narrative, they were symbolic of the desire to usurp the authority of the landlord. They were declarations of independence from the true God, yet also expressions of underlying religious needs. In their religiosity, they sought to exalt themselves above the true and the living God. And so God, as you know, from the biblical story, you know that God judges humanity once again. So that's the biblical story. Stories matter. Narratives matter. Someone has described culture as the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. So narratives matter. And there are a number of additional narratives that we encounter in our culture. One is the so-called wilderness narrative that sees the created order before humans, especially from an evolutionary model, the created order before humans entered as being pristine and perfect. Seems to me the problem with that narrative is that it ignores the fact that, as philosophers and naturalists have pointed out over and over again, nature is red in tooth and claw. The wilderness, even untouched by humanity, is still flawed and fallen. And there's decay and corruption and death and suffering that are part of the forest. When you walk into a forest, even if no human being had ever been there, there would still be the corruption and the suffering. Maybe the wilderness is not quite so pristine. And by the way, those who usually promulgate that view, that perspective, would go on to argue that human beings are somehow parasites, or that all of the suffering of the world, the created order, is because human beings have entered that created order. And again, the problem with that narrative is there's plenty of suffering quite apart from human interventions. Secondly, there's a recovery narrative. There are those who would say what we need to do is to go back to the future, if you will. We should go back to the pristine wilderness, and that narrative has the same problems as the one I just mentioned. And then there is the conservation narrative. No, we can't go back to the pristine wilderness. Humanity's not a parasite, but we must preserve some of the wilderness. And so green space has become part of the mantra and the calling, I think. I'm all for green space. It's part of the calling that we have to preserve God's created order, to be stewards over God's created order. In other words, not to put concrete over everything. So those are other stories that are woven into the culture. We have the creation narrative 1.0. We have these other narratives, and I want to introduce you in a moment to a second narrative, because technology is sometimes flawed, like my PowerPoint slide. I see you can't read that. Let me go on. Creation narrative 2.0. Here is the narrative that you and I, especially those of us from North America, others of us from the West in general, here is the narrative that you and I have inherited. This is the narrative mapped out by David Nye, a philosopher of technology. This is the narrative that we breathe and we swim in, we have inherited. This is our story. This is the story we tell ourselves about ourselves. This is Creation Narrative 2.0. A group, individuals, others, enter an underdeveloped region, and they bring with them one or more new technologies. And using these technologies, they reshape the order in certain ways. They transform the region. They make it something new. They make it something different. It becomes a different kind of order. And so a new settlement prospers, and settlers arrive to occupy this new territory. Land values increase. Some of the settlers become wealthy. And then that original landscape is replaced by a second creation, which is largely shaped, largely formed, largely the result of the engineering of these new technologies. And then someone pushes further, and we start all over again. This is the story of the westward movement. This is the story of the conquering of space. This is the story of the conquering of the oceans. This is the narrative that we've inherited as Westerners. This is the narrative that we've inherited as Americans. This from James Fenimore Cooper. You'll know some of his works, but this from The Chain Bearer. The American axe. Listen to the language. It has made more real and lasting conquests than the sword of any warlike people that ever lived. But they've been conquests that have left civilization in their train. They are conquests which have, instead of havoc and desolation, brought about great advancement. So here is that celebration of the technology, the celebration of human ingenuity, of human innovation, of human technological achievement, even if it's just a technology like an axe. I'll come back and give you a definition of technology in a moment, but just think of technology as any extension of the human will or power beyond the body. A paperclip can be a technology. A rubber or plastic bottle can be a technology, any extension of our human powers. Or, this is from the North American Review. Listen to the language from the 19th century. And notice I have kept the capitalization. Where she, that is nature, has denied us rivers, mechanism, capitalized. Mechanism has supplied them. Where she has left our planet uncomfortably rough, mechanism has applied the roller. Where the mountains have been found in the way, mechanism has boldly leveled or cut through them. Mechanism is the great force that is applied to the wilderness, that is applied to the creative order, to make it habitable, to make it hospitable, to make it something where human beings can flourish and human beings can thrive. Again, this seems, on at least at first blush, this seems to be a logical extension of the creation narrative, to be stewards, to be those who are caring for and those who are keeping and those who are having a stewardship dominion over the order that God has placed us in, over the world that He has made and placed us in as stewards. The famous emancipator, he said, before then, and you'll see when the then is, but before then any man might instantly use what another had invented. So, in order to protect the invention, in order to protect the innovation, in order to protect the new technology, a patent system had to be devised so that you could protect your invention. And this is the great idea of people like John Locke. Locke, who argued in his two treatises of government that for the protection of intellectual property rights, but he does so, He does so through the intellect, the protection of property in general. And it's Locke in those two treaties who says that those who come to the land where the Native Americans have been living a nomadic kind of life, those who come to the land and improve it, that is, till the soil, put fences around the fields, build a house. They're not nomads. They stick in one place and they improve the land. They have a right to ownership of that land. And so from that comes a patent system. If you have invented a new technology, if you have invented a new process, an innovation, you should have ownership rights of that process or that item, and the patent system protects your ownership of that property. And by that protection, by the protection of those property rights, will be fueled, listen to the language, fueled the fire of genius. I mean, after all, says the argument. After all, if you have an idea and you put that idea out there, and any old person can use it without any kind of remuneration or any kind of protection of your idea, if anybody can use that, then nobody would ever come up with a new idea, never share it with anybody. It would be secret. And so we need a system that's going to protect innovation, at least for a period of time, protect innovation as the fuel for additional innovation. Now, what kind of innovation are we talking about? Well, here's I think, a very helpful definition of technology. We can talk about its merits or demerits, but this is at least the place I like to start. Stephen Monsma and his colleagues at Calvin have a really helpful volume, some years old now, called Responsible Technology. And they simply describe technology as a distinct human cultural activity. So innovation, creativity, stewardship, all of those are part of our cultural activities. A distinct human cultural activity in which humans exercise freedom and responsibility in response to God by forming and transforming the natural creation with the aid of tools and procedures for practical ends and purposes. Now think about how you would define technology and compare it and contrast it with this definition. I think this is a very helpful framing of what we might mean, especially from a Christian worldview perspective, what we might mean by technology. It is a response to God. It is part of our mandate. It is part of our calling. It's part of our responsibility before God to form and transform the natural creation with the aid of tools and procedures for practical ends and purposes. Homo sapiens, human knowers, are also homo faber. They are human makers. We are meant to extend our knowing to making, to doing, to creating, to fashioning, to innovation. It's part of our call as stewards. Now, how we exercise that call, we'll need to talk about, but it is part of our call, and it's to be celebrated. The work, the vocation that God has given us to innovate, to be creative, the work, the vocation that God has called us to be stewards who are bringing the rebellion of the created order into subjection to Christ in appropriate ways, that's to be celebrated. And I think, you know, lights are a good opportunity for us to celebrate that. And central heat and air is a good opportunity for us to celebrate that. And sometimes even technologies like PowerPoint are helpful means to celebrate that. But are there questions? Are there concerns? Are there important considerations that we need to think through as we develop and as we embrace technological innovation, Or should it just be kind of helter-skelter, whatever comes down the pike, it doesn't matter? Well, I think you know the answer to that already. Technology is not an unalloyed good. Technology brings with it lots of potential problems. The air conditioning has a polluting effect. It cools us, but it also has the potential to harm the atmosphere, etc. Or let me give you another example. Technology is not a value-free, I'll make this point several times, is not a value-free thing or a value-free phenomenon. The idea sometimes is sometimes suggested that technologies are neither good nor bad, it's just how you use them. There are good uses of technologies and bad uses of technology. I'll come back later. I want to challenge that notion because there are all sorts of values that underwrite the development of certain technologies. But let me just give you an example of how this has worked in our particular context. So under President Eisenhower in the 1950s, a vast ribbon of superhighways or interstates were developed across the United States. And we all are very familiar with these. We spend lots of time on these, and they bring us goods and services that would be much more expensive and much more difficult to obtain did we not have these interstate highways. It was a great boon to the American economic and mercantile system to have the interstates, not to mention just good old transportation. But think about the implications of that. The implications of one, the vastness of the United States, and two, this huge system of interstates now brings with it lots of interesting implications. For one, we have our fuel costs. Not just fuel costs, kind of broad or writ large, but fuel costs for every one of us who owns a car. So we all have to have an individual, we choose to have an individual automobile. We spend lots of dollars every year on gas. We have to maintain the automobile. We have to keep tires on it. We have to have the oil changed or change the oil ourselves. There's maintenance involved. And that's for every household that's represented here today. I doubt, there could be a few exceptions, but I doubt that there are very many people in the room who don't own or are trying to own, renting or leasing or paying for an individual automobile. Now that in itself raises the question of value. Why? Why must we all have our individual automobile? Aren't there other ways to get around? Well, yes, there are. But one, they're less convenient. And two, we can't choose the time we want to leave. We have to go on someone else's schedule, either the bus system or the train system. There are lots of trade-offs, and we've decided that in our culture, in our situation, our circumstance, in our context, that we would prefer the costs and whatever is required, the difficulties and challenges to have an individual automobile. Now, as I said yesterday, and I know there are others here in the room, I've spent a good bit of time in Europe. And Europeans have made different choices about their primary modes of transportation. There are plenty of cars in Europe. I don't want to suggest that. But I would spend entire summers in Oxford, and if I wanted to spend years in Oxford, I could without owning an individual automobile. In fact, in many places in Europe, it's a liability to have a car. The costs are enormous, especially fuel costs or petrol costs, and there's nowhere to park. So it's extraordinarily expensive to own an individual automobile. But moreover, instead of investing in a vast system of interstate highways like we have in the United States, Europeans, by and large, there are motorways and there are highways, but by and large, Europeans have chosen to invest in public transportation. It's not without its faults. I'm not championing that necessarily. There are delays, there are accidents, there are all kinds of things that make public transportation difficult. But nevertheless, there were choices that were made. Values inform those choices. How people thought about the form of life they wanted to live, the way that they wanted to inhabit the world, those values informed their choices as they developed transportation systems. I think it's an interesting test case for us to think through. What are the values that inform our adoption of various types of technology or technological innovation? What is it? What is the form of life that we want? And how do those values about that form of life inform the way we choose technology or we develop technology? And I'm afraid, my fear is, my worry is, and what's sort of behind my whole series of lectures is that we don't think much about it. And I'll show you others who worry that we don't think much about that we are simply uncritical adoptionists of technology. I'll give you another example, the cell phone. Most of you in the room won't remember this thing called the brick that you held up to your ear, the first cell phone. But we have made ways to make it more portable. We decided we needed not to be encumbered with this brick, but to be able to carry around our cell phone. And so we have miniaturized. Technology has helped us to miniaturize the cell phone, make it smaller and smaller. I don't know how small it's going to get, but I want to suggest that we will decide, we are now, and we will continue to decide, that even being encumbered by such a small device is more trouble than we want to go to. I forget this sometimes, you know. Apple. One of the interesting things about technology is that if a technology doesn't work, we have another technology to fix it, right? So Apple has an app now where you can find your phone if you lose it. It's part of our story, part of our narrative. So I think that we're going to soon be so annoyed with having to carry this thing around that we'll just have them implanted. And this will fix things for us. We won't have to worry about losing it or worry about being stolen. It will just be part of us. It will be engineered into us. I'll show you tomorrow afternoon, I'll show you that the next big technology is the wedding of digital technologies and human biology. And this is at least what will be soon a primitive example of that. Notice that bottom quote from this article in the St. Pete Times. At the airport early one recent morning, a guy in black slacks was standing at the magazine rack. "You know, I like machines a lot better than I like humans," said businessman Richard Will before flying to Knoxville, Tennessee. I just have to interface with humans to do business." Let me suggest, and increasingly you and I face this, but let me suggest if you're more comfortable in front of your computer than you are in front of another person, there might be some issues that we need to talk about. We're meant to be social creatures, we'll talk more about that. So we have this exponential growth of technology. We now have a digital world that we have no idea where it's going to go. All the result of this impetus toward human innovation, toward technological innovation, toward technological creativity, toward technological advance, if you will. We don't know what the next few generations are going to be, and that's one of the things I want to at least speculate a little bit about as we move through this series. So somebody asked me, one of your students asked me, so you got any softball questions you want me to throw? And I said, I'm so interested in just getting softball questions, I'm going to ask my own. So I want to put some questions on the table for us to discuss, and then I'd love for you to talk about that. So here we are, human beings, Homo sapiens, who are also Homo faber. Part of our responsibility is to exercise stewardship, innovation, technological advance. We are to be makers and not just thinkers. We are not just brains on a stick, and I'll come back to that theme later in the series. But we are to be creative. But I wonder, there are questions now that our unique context in history, questions that haunt me a little bit, and I want us to talk about those. First of all, there is a notion that technology and the use of technologies is deterministic. To put it this way, if we have a technology, we will use it. Is that really true, and must we be determined in that way? Must predestination be a kind of technological theme that we want to play out? Is it true? Is this inevitability true? Or can we in some ways harness or shepherd or guide technology? And I think we could point to a few. There aren't many technologies that we have developed but chosen not to use. Mustard gas would be one so far. After, at least, World War II, we have not used nuclear weapons, but we'll see how long that lasts. Does technology enhance or restrict human freedom? You remember that the definition that Monsma and company used for technology was an expression of human freedom. But could human freedom be challenged by technology? And my example would be, so let's say that in the not too distant future, within your lifetime, we will be able to cure many genetically linked illnesses or disease. We'll do so through manipulating the genome, manipulating the human genetic blueprint. And many people would applaud that. And I think I think that there may be times and maybe ways in which we could do some of that ethically and morally. However, my experience or our experience of the application of those technologies thus far is a little bit troubling. For instance, today there are three tests that can be used to determine whether a child, either in vitro or in utero, is carrying the markers for Down syndrome. What that means today is that 90% of children diagnosed with Down syndrome are not brought to term. So my question is, If we continue to develop the technologies that allow us to both diagnose and potentially to treat disability, if you and your spouse choose to bring a disabled child into the world, one, will you be able to? Will they say, sorry, we can't pay for that. We're not going to support that. Or two, will you face public shame, as many couples who have children with disabilities do today? People say, I can't believe you chose to bring a child like that into the world. So what happened to freedom? The technology may not enhance our freedom. It may restrict our freedom in important ways. As I say, I really question the notion that technology is value neutral. I won't go through all of these right now, but let me just say that there are certain assumptions behind our adoption and invention of certain technologies. And some of those include, and I'll come back to this theme later, Some of those include the notion that technology always enables us to do more faster. That's efficiency. Technology always enables us to do more faster. It helps us to be more efficient. And in some areas, of my tasks, I'm very, very happy for technology to help me be more efficient, right? Aren't you glad that you don't have to do what some of us had to do and type your papers one page at a time, and when you made a mistake, erase on the page and put a little hole in the page or find some other way, whiteout came later, that you can just do all this on the screen, and you can print out a pristine, well, no, you can print out paper, whether it's got errors in it or not. You can print it out. It's a wonderful technology. It helps us be more efficient. But do we want every relationship, every aspect of our form of life to be governed by efficiency? What if my wife and I were sitting down at our future 50th anniversary, Lord willing? We're sitting down at our 50th anniversary dinner. She looks over at me and she says, "Ben," sparkle in her eye, "Ben, you've been the most efficient husband a woman could want." What am I supposed to say to that? Is that a compliment or an insult? Is it a category mistake? Or is she talking about, you know, my ability to do rapid housework? I don't know. But I don't think it's appropriate. I don't think there's something wrong with that notion. But if all of our relationships are to be governed or mediated through technology, and the promise is technology is going to give us greater efficiency, then maybe there's a problem. How about, are biotechnologies qualitatively different from other technologies? Is there a difference in engineering your phone and engineering the next generation of humans? If so, where is that line? Where are the limits? Where are the boundaries? Does technology concentrate power? For instance, if there are certain people who have access to certain technologies, like technologies for genetic manipulation, genetic therapies, genetic enhancements one day, do you create a class system in which there are the genetic haves and the genetic have-nots? Does it concentrate power? Do patenting regimes, like we talked about earlier, do they apply to every area of life? So you know now that it is possible to have a patent on human tissues, genes, and cells. You can patent a certain bit of the human DNA. It's controversial and still running through the courts, but it's at least on the table. Does the democratization of technology, the fact that it's so ubiquitous and so many of us have access to it, does it mean the democratization of evil, the hackers? Now, high school students can hack, and are, or younger even. Are notions of nature or human nature or naturalness appropriate or even worth preserving? You know, is there going to be such a thing anymore as the nature as we receive it, or is everything about nature going to be a project that we undertake, our DIY, our do-it-yourself project, because we now have powerful technologies? Finally, with the speed of technological development in the 21st century, is it realistic to imagine regulating shepherding? Is it inevitable? Is it deterministic? And I would just want to at least hold open the possibility that it's not. That, as Nye says, machines, technologies are not like meteors that come unbidden from the outside, but rather we make choices about technologies. And where we're going is to think through how we make those choices. Let me give you a cautionary tale, and I'll take a few minutes of questions. This is a Skolt Laplander. Wonderful people group. The Skolt Laplanders historically have been herders, nomads, who have essentially followed the reindeer. They didn't have corrals. They didn't have means to herd the reindeer, except to kind of follow them and kind of nudge them along, if you will. So someone said, let's help the Laplanders become more efficient. They'll make more money. If they can get these reindeer herds to market, then they'll be able to they'll be able to have a better standard of living. Over against the old way, as one sociologist put it, as long as a man had reindeer herds, he could always get food for his family and sell a little bit to get needed cash. Then came the technology. Someone said, let's help them by getting them snowmobiles so that they can herd these animals more efficiently. But what happened was, from 1960 to 1971, the animals, the herds, went from domestication to a return to the wild, because as they pushed them back into the woods with the snowmobiles, they fled into the woods, they stopped this gentle movement through the land. So herding went from an experience of, you know, the kind of pastoral experience of shepherding these reindeer to a chaotic rampage. And the reindeer, because of the way they were herded, began to suffer a failure to thrive, especially the young. This was too much pressure, too much stress on them. And the industry, if you will, went from being person-intensive to machine-efficient. And it went from being the cost being about $1.30 a head to get these reindeer to market to $3.30 a head to get these reindeer to market. And so the market could not bear this cost. So in this case, the technology actually meant that the herders went from employment to unemployment. So it's a cautionary tale. It's one that requires we think through these technologies and what they will mean to our form of life, to our way of life. So I think that's the last slide. I'd be happy to take questions if you have questions or comments. Or you can text them to me. That's a great question that nobody's ever asked me. I'd have to go back to Pelto to ask that. I'm certain that it was someone from the business community who was trying to help. I don't think there was any motivation to harm, but I feel certain it was someone from the business community in that culture who said, this is a way that we can help these folks make more money. We can enhance their quality of life. So that unintended I have to give you another example. So when I moved to Trinity to teach, I had an opportunity to live with, for 5 weeks, a third-generation missionary to India, Paul Hebert. And Dr. Hebert told me that when he was in India, that the way they grew rice in his part of India was using elephants, and the elephants and oxen. And the oxen would go through the rice paddies and they would cultivate the rice that way. So someone said, let's help them. Let's bring tractors. Tractors, technology is going to fix it. And so they brought tractors in. Well, what happened was, when the ox moved through the rice fields, the rice paddies, they were actually aerating the soil. The weight of the tractors compacted the soil, or compacted the paddies, and it actually meant that the rice wouldn't grow. So here's again another example where an uncritical application of a technology actually turned out to cause harm rather than good. Yes, sir.
Out of a job, and what will people
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, if you just read headlines, just use your favorite search engine, and hit robots and employment, and you'll see that the worry is that we're going to so automate the future that we're going to create a condition of unemployment for many, many people. And we're seeing robots even in nursing homes and hospitals now, in hotels, and every robot is going to take up a job that was once a job held by a human being. So it's a concern. It's a worry. My colleague and friend Nigel Cameron is coming out in the next couple months with an evangelical Christian coming out with a book on robotics. It'd be worth seeing and I think the title is something like, "Will Robots Take My Job?" I mean, it's something that kind of straightforward, and it'd be worth taking a look at Nigel Cameron, his work on that. But it's a concern. It's a concern. Now, there have to be people who program. There have to be people who invent. They're still, for a while, at least. But it's still a worry. It's a great question. I do want to revisit that question this afternoon and tomorrow. But my snarky answer was going to be, you have to come back. But I won't do that. You should come back. But in any case, no, I do think we can make choices. In fact, I think some of us, just to give you a hint, some of us may have to become the technological Amish. I say that using PowerPoint. So there's nuance there.